Welcome to the Government Services Chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians podcast. GSASEP represents emergency physicians who work in the federal government, including active duty military, National Guard, and military reserves, as well as the Veterans Administration, Indian Health Service, and other federal agencies. Our mission is advancing emergency care for America's heroes. In this podcast, we bring you lectures and conversations with leaders in federal emergency medicine to help you better care for your patients and lead your departments. The views expressed on this podcast are personal views and do not represent the views of the Department of Defense, any branch of the military, or the federal government, and they do not constitute endorsement of any product by any of these entities.
Standard disclosures, right? Nothing financial disclosed. But the important one is, these are my views and my views alone. Travis Deaton is talking to you today. I'm going to be very opinionated on my thoughts, and I'm looking for feedback, and I'm looking for people to have some other thoughts and ideally some dissenting thoughts on where we're going here. I like to start off operational briefs with this slide right here. It's the Defense Casualty Analysis System. This is a public-facing website. Anybody can go on your smartphone right now, and you can look at this. And they will track our casualty statistics for not just the five named overseas contingency operations that you see up here, but you can go back and look at World War II data, Vietnam data. Don't worry about all the numbers that are up there. Draw your attention to this number in the bottom right-hand corner. Over 60,000 patients. 60,000 patients, roughly 20 years. That's 10 patients a day, every single day, that were casualties coming back from overseas contingency operations for 20 years in a row. The collective we have a huge amount of experience about what our patient data set looks like, albeit from a different theater than what our next theater is likely going to look like, under different conditions. But this knowledge of 60,000 people was earned through blood, sweat, and tears. We can't forget about that. So I think it's a good place to go look at every once in a while. I think it grounds us as to why we're here and why we're doing what we're doing. Obviously, when we talk a little bit about taking physicians or providers that are trained in a hospital, that's climate controlled, it's secure, it's got good lighting, we've got all sorts of backup staff that are helping us out on any given day. And when you ask for a piece of equipment, that piece of medical equipment or gear is usually readily available. Has anybody accidentally dropped a wire from a central line on the ground ever before their careers? And then you turn and you say, get me another kit, right? Another kit magically appears out of nowhere. That's the paradigm we've all been trained to work in and that we're comfortable working in. Now, go back and remember the first time that you did an EMS ride-along. I don't know about you, but mine was a total disaster, right? We are not trained, nor do we practice, working in low-light conditions, moving conditions, places where you don't have backup, places where you're not necessarily secure. You see this in the hospital every day, right? If you respond to a code, especially if there's some junior residents that's in a non-traditional medical facility where there's not a patient in a gown sitting in a bed. So for example, you know, the fast food joint that's at the hospital or the floor of the pharmacy, people get out of their loop, right? What they've trained to do. They don't know how to react to that situation. There are all sorts of great civilian organizations that are out there that'll help you with that problem set, right? I just listed a few. These are just kind of representations that are out there. Obviously, the pre-hospital trauma life support class is a great course that's tied very closely with the military as well. People can get a fellowship, right? I'm sure there's plenty of fellow trained EMS folks in the room. But then there's also those folks that, you know, that if you want to go take care of somebody who's sailing on a ship out in the middle of the sea or somebody on an extended hike in the wilderness or in backcountry skiing, there's some fantastic organizations that'll help you through that, but that's not what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about this as an extreme example of what long-range medicine is going to look like for the Navy. So I'm sure there's plenty of folks in the room who are very familiar with distributed operations, but we're going to park here for a little bit, and we're going to try to shape this so that we all have a pretty good understanding of what this means going forward. This is an unclassified brief. This is an open source map chip that I randomly pulled off the internet, specifically off the marines.mil public facing website, and it shows the anti-access aerial denial capability of a random country. In this case, it's focused on China. So what you're seeing are those range rings that project away from China are cruise missiles, anti-ship missiles, anti-aircraft missiles, ballistic missiles, fighter attack and bomber aircraft. This is how far out away from the coast of China they are able to project lethal munitions. There's a concept that Admiral Hancock referred to of the first island chain. The first island chain stretches from Japan south through the Ryukyus and Okinawa, through Taiwan, further south through the Philippines, right? Those are the close island chains. You can see that those island chains are very well covered by the range rings and are considered in the weapon zone, the WEZ. Those are inside of the WEZ for a potential conflict. There's a second island chain a little further out, right? Stretches from northern Japan out to Hawaii. Some might say all the way down to New Zealand, Australia even. That's a little further out that isn't quite as included in that weapons engagement zone, that danger zone. So what you don't see depicted here are a few things. You don't see the maritime naval assets that have individual range rings with capabilities they can reach out and touch people with, because they're moving around on a daily basis, right? But they're out there. You don't see the sensing capabilities, right? So when we talk about sensing capabilities, it's across the entire electromagnetic spectrum. This is going to be important, specifically for our long-range medicine response we're going to talk about. But when I say sensing, that's everything from the Mark 1 Mod 0 eyeball, right? Being able to look at something and say, hey, I see something that is different, that might not necessarily be here. And specifically, how many Chinese fishing vessels do you think are in this region? Thousands, right? All with eyeballs, able to get on a VHF radio or a cell phone and report back to say what they're seeing. Up to, you know, we talk about sensing capabilities, we're talking about 20-year-old, low-tech, relatively, satellites that just have not even high resolution, so low resolution visibility, all the way up to some insane sensing technologies that we're not going to talk about in this particular space today, but I'll tell you, are driven by AI to be able to sift through massive amounts of data that are looking very specifically at this region. The third thing you don't see on there are the electronic warfare capabilities. So we've been operating for the last 20 years in the overseas contingency operations under a very permissive communication environment. We were able to reach out and talk to people when we wanted to. That being said, who has ever struggled in the military on a radio trying to talk to somebody? And that's a 100% permissive environment that we've been in. Now, what happens when we start degrading those capabilities? So keeping that in mind, I promise this is going somewhere. Let's look at the paradigm for, let's take a generic medium-sized Rule 2 capability that we've brought into the overseas contingency operations in the last 20 years. So what are we talking about? Talking about what? 20 to 40 medical packs, somewhere in that range. About four medium to large size tents, two generators, some communications equipment, what, two or three field ambulances. You may be co-located next to rotary wing aircraft that are parked alongside to help you get patients to and from your Role 2 facility, right? But it's not just not the medical folks, right? We had to have attached security, communicators, logisticians, cooks maybe, planners. All those folks needed a place to sleep, so we built extra tents for them. I'm sure I'm missing out, like, you know, fuel, all the other sort of logistical supplies that are coming along with a Role 2 facility. Are you going to need a high-fidelity, high-resolution satellite or ISR platform to see that footprint on this battlefield? No, right? Mark 1 Mod 0 eyeball is going to tell you exactly where we put that medical capability. Now, our potential future enemies in a pacing enemy threat, near-peer conflict, they have the same kill chain issues that we do. So we talk about a kill chain. You got to find a target, assess a target, and figure out if you want to execute that target. So my very simple Travis Deaton mind, somebody's looking on a screen, well, I found something. It's got like six tents and a couple vehicles. I only have so many missiles. Do I push the button or not? Right. And I would argue that if you've got a footprint that big, that is a very juicy potential target.
Right.
So lesson number one, we got to get small. Now, that's just a visual aspect. We like power, right? We like to run our lights and our medical equipment that requires power. What do you think happens every time we fire up one of those generators? They put out a whole lot of heat, right? From a sensing capability, that heat's going to get found in a heartbeat. When we call for patient transport or we receive a 9-line request, assuming we can because we're in a calm, degraded environment, what are we doing? We're giving away the position and potentially what we're doing and what we're moving. So we've got to stay light, mobile, hidden, stay off the EM spectrum. This has nothing to do with medicine. We're talking long-range medicine. We haven't even touched on the medical piece yet. But these are important concepts, and they're key concepts. We talked a little bit about role two. I'd like to go back and talk about role one, old paradigm. OCO operations. Role one medicine, you are a good medic, and you're on the ground. You are already calling for that 9-line CASAVAC before you were even finished on your initial assessment, right? So obviously the Gates effect, looking at our time to get rotary ring aircraft on station. Realistically, when things were going well, you had under 30 minutes from the time you called that CASAVAC, the time there was a rotary wing on deck picking up your patient. Typically, you didn't even get to make it through your entire assessment and get them packaged up before they're ready to take them off your hands. In this environment where we do not have air superiority, we've got to break that thought process. Nobody's coming in 30 minutes to pick up your patient. The time distance is too great, and the fact that they can't safely get surface connectors, air connectors, ground connectors in is going to severely limit our abilities to medevac folks out in a hurry. We'll talk about a little bit about planning factors, but I'm going to throw out, expect 72 plus hours that you're going to be holding on to a patient. So as we wrap this up, when we think about the problem set, you got to be small. You don't want to get found. You got to be able to move fast. You can't have a lot of gear, and you can't admit anything on the EM spectrum. You're talking about small teams. Not just medical teams. I'm talking small military teams. 20, 30 people-ish max, right, in one location. They can move in a hurry once they get sensed, and they got to move to a different location. So what's your medical support for that? You got 20 or 30 warfighters out there, non-medical. How many medical folks do you put with them to take care of them? I don't know about you guys, but I have trained my entire career to be the best that I could possibly be. If somebody gets injured on the battlefield, I want to be standing next to them. That's what I've dedicated my life towards. The reality is, it's not going to be us. The reality is, it's going to be a junior corpsman or a junior medic who is going to be our center of influence, right? That's going to be taking care of those folks. So we'll train, we'll learn it, but at the end of the day, we have to learn how to man, train, and equip our forces going forward. All right. So with that good news, this is how I look at things, right? So we put things on a spectrum of care. We heard Admiral Hancock talk about phase zero shaping operations, right? This is where nobody's shooting at this point, but the military actions that are happening in a competition phase, we've got folks deployed away from the continental United States. And we really got to focus on the disease and that non-battle injury. So this is our non-trauma skills in the emergency department. These are our sick call skills for folks who are in operational units. And we can't forget that there's a couple kind of unique things, right? Our tropical medicine, the mental health, the orthopedic injuries, and obviously the unique women's health issues that come up on deployment. In this spectrum, we're going to have to assume at some point things are going to go kinetic. And that's what that little fake explosion up there is supposed to look like. When that happens, we tip from phase zero to phase three operations. We're in combat now. And you should expect to see more combat trauma and a little bit less DMBI. Now, we've got some programs that are in place to help people work through this long-range medicine. Because remember, you might not be able to call for help. You got limited amount of equipment, limited amount of personnel, and you're going to have to hold on to it for 72 plus hours. The way I look at it in my mind is we've got tactical combat casualty care. We've got plenty of data that shows for the first 15 to 30 minutes, well-executed tactical combat casualty care will save lives. That's got to be the foundation of where we focus our efforts. So if everybody in this room does not feel like they are the absolute subject matter expert on tactical combat casualty care, I'd ask that we go back and look at that again. Right? We need to be. At the end of 30 minutes, you've kind of run through your TC3 protocols and you're sort of stuck. What do I do now? I think we've also proven that whole blood saves lives. So what we've done, 1st Marine Division is instituted what we call a Valkyrie blood program, but it's nothing more than a low titer role whole blood program that can be executed by medics with the assistance of Marines with no medical officers present to be able to continue that resuscitation. What do I estimate? Gosh, that might buy you another 60, 90 minutes. And then what? Because help's still not coming. This is when we went back and we looked at our prolonged casualty care programs to really try to figure out how to train people for that 72 plus hours holding onto a patient before you can get somebody to come help pick you up. This is why I don't sleep at night, right? Trying to solve this problem set. Again, nobody has interrupted me and challenged me yet. Please do. We'll start a little bit with some tactical combat casualty care stuff. The kind of plug for the image on the bottom right there. So deployed in medicine. I love, one of my favorite pastimes is complaining about DHA. I love it. But if there is one thing that DHA got absolutely right, it's this app. And if it's not on your phone, you don't have it downloaded yet, I would implore you, beg you. Deployed Health, it's free. It does a couple things for you. It's got all of the JTS clinical practice guidelines on it. Back in the days, I don't know if you remember, we would deploy. Everybody be like, hey, do you have the newest one? Or did you get the new one over email? Or can I find the updated version? As soon as they're updated, they go up on this app. You can pull them down and download them if you need offline, you know, offline access to them. And not only that, it's got all of the training materials. So if you have to give an impromptu class for TC3 or an impromptu class for like any of your kind of roll two or roll three stuff, all those training materials are included on there. Makes it really easy. This free app, they actually did right. So I'd ask you to please go take a look at it. I'm not going to insult anybody's intelligence, but I'm just going to briefly cover what the purpose behind the four different tiers of tactical combat casualty care were. When they say tiers, it's just target audience, right? So the idea being, you know, teaching a paramedic to do a bunch of interventions in tactical combat casualty care is going to take a little bit of time, and they come in with a little bit of information and skill set beforehand. But the all service members, like anybody that's working in maybe an administration or a logistical position, they don't need a week and a half course, and they also don't need to know how to do high-level procedures, so we've kind of tiered it out. So tier one is your all-service members. Tier two are your combat lifesavers. Tier three are your combat medics and your corpsmen. And then tier four is your paramedics and your providers. Sir? Admiral, completely agree, right? When I go back to this slide, right? What are we asking of our combat medics and our corpsmen? I want you to be a family care doc on the left side of this, right? With a little bit of OB experience and a little bit of mental health experience. And then I want you to be an ER doc and an ER nurse. And then I want you to be a transfusionist. And then ultimately, I'm going to ask you to be a critical care nurse, a critical care provider, and an RT for our 20 to 21-year-old target audience who hasn't been to medical school, right? This is a big ask. The problem set we're looking at, and we didn't brief the casualty statistics or numbers, is it's a numbers game. There are not enough of us to tackle what the likely casualties of a near-peer competitor are going to look like. So we've got to enable some of these skills for the folks that are going to be there. So point well taken, Admiral, but it's a numbers issue that obviously we're concerned about as well. I will say, just from an administrative perspective, tier one, tier two, tier three, all the training curriculum, all the videos are up on deployed medicine. The one that's still in works is tier four. So you can't get access to tier four yet. It's still being built out. Don't worry about this chart, right? So this is just an organizational chart that looks at what, you know, who's in charge of JTS and who does what for who. Don't worry about that. I want you to pay attention to what's on the bottom here, right? This is not one of those situations where JTS and the Defense Committee on Trauma is an us versus them. JTS and the Defense Committee on Trauma is all of us, right? We are the ones that contribute to this body of work and this body of knowledge. The CPGs, the curriculums that come out, this is the joint curriculum. This is the purple curriculum. Right? The medicine is purple. If you look, for example, the Committee on TCCC that puts out the guidelines both for TC3 and PCC has 106 or GP doc assigned to it. That particular person that's filling that billet right now is Captain Drew, who is also a command surgeon, right? This is his collateral duty he does on the weekends. We, as a community, are what make this up. All the services, getting together, validating, you know, doing the research, the literature search, looking at what our levels of recommendations are, figuring out how to write the guidelines, update the guidelines, and how to teach this to people. So this is a coalition of the willing from all services. And I would challenge you, if you have an interest in this and you're not engaged in this, let me know. Come talk to me. We have more projects and more requirements than we have people to fill. And it's going to be an extra job, right? But I also think it's one that we can buy into. JTS is not us versus them. We collectively are JTS. There's a couple people that keep the lights on for us on a day-to-day basis. I put this DOD instruction up there. They came out early in 2022 that said a couple things, but you know, across the DOD, I'll read a couple things out here. So tactical combat casualty care is the standard of care, right? It is the DOD standard of care, clear as day. And that all service members from all services should take this because it meets the JROCMs requirements that are out there. It also said that this is where we got the deployedmedicine.com website, saying that that's going to essentially be the repository to where we find these resources going forward. Luckily, we got some buy-in, right? So after this came out as a DOD instruction, the Air Force were the first ones to the street saying, yeah, understood. Less than 3 weeks later, the Air Force says, we in the Air Force will do the purple medicine, the joint medicine. A little bit later, Department of the Navy, about a month later, came out and said, all right, Air Force, Navy's going to do the same thing. We'll practice the purple medicine. Took a little bit longer, but the Marines in the summer said, we will practice the purple medicine as well. So what do you think? Next slide, Army, Space Force, haven't come on board yet, right? That DOD instruction's been on the street for over a year, haven't come on board yet formally as a service. Again, we as a community need to drive this. I'm going to talk a little bit about the change paper process because this is what we do, right? We go back and we revisit. We look at what new data, what new information is out there. Are the recommendations and guidelines that we put out previously, are they still valid, or do we need to change them around a little bit? If you looked at the fluid resuscitation for hemorrhagic shock recommendations in TC3 previously, it would walk through your blood options, but it would pay a little bit of respect to the fact that taking blood on the battlefield is hard. It's logistically difficult. And we left on two things. We left on the colloid hextin, and we left the clear fluids, plasmolite, and normal saline. Now, if you're a medical logistician trying to figure out, well, I got a bunch of cold blood options I got to figure out how to source, or I could just drop ship some hextin that's got a 2 or 3 year shelf life, which are you going to choose? Yeah, hextin for sure, right? How easy is that? Done. Don't even have to think about it again. Who here's given hextin for their primary traumatic research or resuscitation fluid of choice in a hospital? Right? We know that harms people and probably kills them. So we have to go back and look at these. I think this is a good one to look at because it's new. When we look at what the current recommendations are for fluid options for shock, cold store, low titer, O-hole blood. So these are coming out of are CONUS-based military blood banks, right? These are screened, they're FDA compliant, and they're universal blood whole blood products that can be given to anybody who comes to the door. They're great, but they're not easy to get a hold of in volume, right? There's not a whole lot of them out there, so they can work for some missions when you go overseas. We're still playing around a little bit with the additives, but right now we're looking at about 42 days, or what the current shelf life of these are. But again, they get drawn, that's from the day they're drawn. They get drawn in a CONUS hospital. They have to go through the testing process. That has to get reported. Then they have to get shipped. So if you're sitting in Indo-PACOM or AFRICOM, you're probably looking at about 25 useful days of service life left on the cold stored low whole blood by the time it gets to you. So it is a solution. It's a safe solution. There's not a lot of harm involved in this, but it is a logistically challenging solution. Second on the list, and these are in order of preference, by the way. Second on the list, pre-screen, low titer, oral, fresh whole blood. We're going to hear a lot about this program later on today. We got some folks on the panel. The panel's going to talk about it maybe a little bit. Yeah, right afterwards. So that's going to be kind of good to talk about. And this is where you know we've named our Valkyrie program, but there's other programs that are out there, and we'll go into that in a little bit. After that, obviously, plasma RBCs and platelets in 1-to-1-to-1, knowing that you're not going to get platelets. Next on the list is just plasma and RBCs in 1-to-1 because platelets are so hard to find in overseas locations. And then at the bottom, if you can't get a 1-to-1, then just give plasma or give our red blood cells. Let's go through these just a little bit. Which of these require refrigeration? Is this one? Yes. This one? This one? Yes. Yes. Kind of yes, but I mean, this is a unicorn, right? If you could find it, great, but the rest of them, it doesn't initially. But it's hard to get a hold of any sort of volume, but all the rest of these do. So what's really our only non-refrigerated option? So if you are a ground force going forward, trying to figure out your blood solution, that's all you got, right? 2022, that's all you have if you're looking for anything in volume. So we put this to the service, specifically to the Marine Corps, and said, you know, look, we got a problem. We can't keep reinventing the wheel. So there's something called a universal needs statement you can put up. With the help of Captain Delk, Admiral Hancock, several other folks in this room, we were able to get the Marine Corps to sign this on as a program of record. Any people that aren't familiar with program of record, you think this is where you get to go to the end zone and spike the football. Turns out it's not. Right? So you got to go through the entire .milpf process, figure out funding and education and where it goes. We're getting there. We're close. We're much closer than we were. So it is now officially a program of record. But now we got to figure out all the details to make sure that we've got these access to low titer oral fresh whole blood programs going forward. This is a great article. This is a really good one to have. Has anybody, there's a couple older folks in here. Has anybody tried to do anything with blood products and been told by a lab officer, absolutely not. We're not doing low titer oral. We're not doing cold store oral, right? So I just had that experience within the last couple of months. And so this came from a blood officer at BUMED. And I said, hey, you know, I hear what you're saying. I know you have some concerns, but you work for the Armed Services Blood Program, correct? Like, that's essentially your higher headquarters. Are you aware of a joint statement that came out between the Joint Trauma System and the senior author on the paper was an Armed Services Blood Program? And they say that we should be doing this stuff. And it ended the argument pretty quickly. This is a good paper to have in your back pocket, because there is a little bit of disconnect sometimes, right? We are going to have to accept what I think is to be, you know, what we're going to take moderate risk by doing low titer oral buddy-to-buddy transfusions. We can mitigate that to low risk, but it's not no risk. And that's what this position paper is supposed to help people be able to go out to their commands and say, we understand that, and everybody's on board with a low-risk program like we have set up. Just a couple storyboards. This is, you know, NSW is looking to formalize their programs. We were training some folks up, you know, with the SEALs to make sure that they understood how to use the Valkyrie program. This is the one I thought for sure I was going to lose my job over, and I didn't yet. We have some unique assets within 1st Marine Division with our force reconnaissance teams because they're small. And they asked if they could send their Marines through with no corpsmen. So this is a course that we held for some force reconnaissance Marines. There is no medical personnel that went through this course. And they scored higher on their practicals and their written exams than as an average in any other class that we've run through so far. So they're capable. Now, great. These are kind of self-selecting, right? These are Marines who are pretty hard charging. But yeah, they're capable of it. Absolutely. And we took that information and we realized we may not want all of our Marines transfusing necessarily, but we could certainly teach them how to draw blood. And they could certainly run the administrative aspects of making sure that we've got, you know, people who are pre-screened and identified and labeled appropriately. And so our Marines have been huge force multipliers for us in our low tyro whole blood programs. I'm not going to talk too much about these because I think these are going to come up a little bit later. But there's some folks in this room who did some excellent work overseas, training our partners on our best practices for low tyro whole programs. And those certainly were used in some very real world circumstances that we're going to talk about later on this conference as well. Is this in yours? I'm not stealing your thunder, am I? Okay. So this is a couple of text messages back and forth with some folks on the ground. When you see the acronym CTM up there, and I'll read it for you. So CTM is our combat trauma management course that we run. It's nothing. So, yep, sounds good. Yeah. It's time to go. He's talked too long. Got it, sir. Copy all. The tactical combat care course, right? That is purple medicine. And it's just medicine. Medicine doesn't change no matter what color uniform you're wearing or where you're working at. How you apply that medicine to your platform, to your aircraft, to your Bradley assault vehicle, to your ship, to your submarine, that's the platform application course. The medicine doesn't change. There are two little different things we got to look at there. So our platform application course is our combat trauma management, our CTM course. This is teaching ground force Marines how to work out of a backpack in the dirt while it's raining at night. Right? That's how we apply our TCCC. So the comments that came out of the HKI attack, right? All of the corpsmen except two have been to combat trauma management. A little irked that two didn't go. But we're working on that. All the Marines were CLS, combat lifesaver trained. So our requirement is to have two per every corpsman, which would only give us about 120 Marines out of a battalion landing team. Instead, they trained up 1,000, right? There was about 100-150 that didn't get a chance to get that training. They trained 1,000 instead. And all of them that were involved were combat lifesaver trained before deployment. A handful from each platoon, Marines, not sailors, Marines, were Valkyrie-trained Marines as well to assist. I wasn't around for the blast of the casualties, but the boys performed. They said if it wasn't for C-Team and Valkyrie, that they wouldn't have known what to do. We can teach this medicine in the hospitals, but if we're not working on the platform application stuff, if we're not giving people the confidence to use these skills forward, we're potentially setting them up for failure. All right, I'm going to talk very briefly about prolonged casualty care for a couple reasons. So first of all, prolongedfieldcare.org. So Sean Keenan, who used to come to these and still does occasionally, retired ER doc, still works at JTS. He was a visionary, right? He worked for the special forces and he realized my situation might be a little different. I might be holding on to folks for an extended period of time and we really don't know how to train people to do that in the special forces. And he really, along with some smart folks, pushed this prolonged field care concept. This website, prolongedfieldcare.org, is a great resource for podcasts, for case studies, for some training, documentation, all sorts of stuff. It's really good to go take a look at. But I want you to notice something. His website, he called prolonged field care, right? And I'm calling this prolonged casualty care. What's the difference? Turns out, I'm going to give you an example. If you're on a submarine, submarines rarely take physicians on them. They have an independent duty corpsman. The mission of that submarine is to go and stay hidden, right? Number one priority, stay hidden. Do not come to the surface. You got a medical problem that you have to deal with, and you can't come to the surface, and you're out in the middle of nowhere trying to hide. Is there a better definition of a like prolonged casualty scenario? Right, that is what submarines do. We took this program to the surface fleet, we took it to the submarine fleet, and we said, hey, prolonged field care, we got to figure this out. And they said, oh, no, we don't go to the field. We're a submarine, we don't deploy to the field. Yeah, but you got to understand, there's a lot of parallels here. We don't go to the field. Would you consider it if we changed the name and called it prolonged casualty care instead of we can get on board then. Right? So even though there's still references to prolonged field care, we're really trying to go and call it more prolonged casualty care because, again, the medicine is purple. Doesn't matter what uniform you're wearing. So this, the initial CPGs just came out at the end of last year. They're, again, on Deployed Medicine if you want to pull up the newest version. They're not perfect. This is version one. They're good. They're not great. And we need smart people to look at this problem set, smart people like the folks in the room that are willing to come to JTS and help us with version two and version three. Is there a starting point? Now, what's not there? Initially comes the guidelines, and then the guidelines drive the curriculum. So we're in the process of writing the curriculum right now. Again, folks that are interested in curriculum development, excellent opportunity. That's a huge, huge beast that we're trying to tackle on trying to figure out the prolonged casualty care piece. But we're on a timeline. Right? I think when Adam Hancock says that he has never in his career felt like we were closer to this potential conflict than today, we need the help. We need folks that are smart and able to help us through it. We'll talk about a couple cases. If I get short in time, somebody's going to weigh me. You give me my purpose. We have to get comfortable with being uncomfortable. So I'll paint the situation here a little bit for you. This is a very small tri-service surgical team. You got a general surgeon, a ER doc, a CRNA, and a PA. Same country, but this is partner forces, got a call. They're about 150 miles away saying, hey, we took a bunch of casualties, a bunch of gunshot wounds. There's no medical resources there. Can you guys help out? That surgical team was engaged in a mission 150 miles away supporting U.S. service members. The answer is no, we can't come to you, but if you can get your patients to us, then we'll do what we can do. Can't promise you anything. Good enough. So they loaded up half dozen patients, GSW to the chest, abdomen, pelvis, and then this gentleman who had a GSW to the left side of the brain, as you can see here. 150 miles in some countries coming down from mountainous terrain and unimproved roads turns out to be an 8-hour car ride. This patient had zero interventions for 8 hours. This gunshot wound to the head. Shows up, GCS of 10, following commands, but no right movement on the right side of the body. And then obviously the entry-exit wound that you see up there. So let me ask you, what do you do? There is no neurosurgeon in this country, and that patient's never going to see a neurosurgeon. There is no neurocritical care bed in this country. You've got limited resources, that you're there for a reason. What do you do with this? Put them off in the corner to die? Give it a shot? Is it easier if you came in with a GCS of 3? Does that make the decision process a little easier? In my mind, it does. But 10? Oh, man, 10? What if this patient went from 10 following commands and was compensated an 8-hour car ride in the back of the truck through the mountains till they got to you, and then in front of your face goes from a 10 to a 7 to a 6 in the first 30 minutes of your assessment? Does that change your calculus at all? There's no right answers, just something to think about. This team decided that they're going to give it a shot, right? Are there folks that have either Treff Nation or Cranies as a regular part of their practice in this room? I'm kind of doubting no, right? But we all think about it, especially as military physicians. And in my mind, like I had, like this is what I'm going to do when this situation arises. And I think back to the pictures and the drawings and, you know, going to the cadaver lab. We practice this in the cadaver lab. And everything in the cadaver lab was pristine anatomy, like older, but pristine anatomy in terms of an intact calvarium and skin and everything else. Everything in the picture showed perfect anatomy before you started this procedure. And then you get your aha moment where you're like, oh man, there's like bone fragments, soft tissue disruption, and my plan didn't survive first contact going in to see this patient, right? So you can see here, obviously, the scalp incision had to be modified to incorporate the wounds. Flaps were raised. I'm going to forget the name. The rainy clips? The little clips? Yeah, rainy clips. Obviously, we're not carrying rainy clips. So when you cut that scalp and it starts bleeding like slink, well, this is going to take a half a minute to sit down and run some lock and sutures and try to get some hemorrhage control. And obviously, no Bovie. No Bovie was available for this case. We had a Burset, Gigli saw, Ronger elevator. And of course, one of the first things that happens is this thing. Can't really see it there, but it's duct taped together because it didn't survive the initial procedure. Bone fragments were removed to get to the Gigli saw. under the wound, right? The elevator used to free the dura. Devitalized brain tissue. Anybody know what devitalized brain tissue looks like? Yeah, I don't either. Looks good. This doesn't. Some stayed, some didn't. Washed out. And then without a Bovie, right? I've never seen anybody publish a paper saying they put combat gauze inside a woman like this to try to get some hemostatic control, but what are you going to do? The dura was closed, and the obviously a drain was placed, and the skin was just stapled. So that patient was extubated about hour 6 or 7, somewhere in there. Did okay. That team got a call post-op day 2. Hey, retasked. You got a critical mission. You're moving. Crap. What do we do about this patient, right? There were some folks that had zero medical training. They were going to be there. All right, let me teach you about Q24 antibiotics that are going to go in through that IV line. This is how you do it. Watch this once. Rest is on you. Feeding somebody for an extended period of time. I don't know. What do you do? You look around. Well, we got some baby formula in the village here, and we got some protein powder. We got some electrolytes and did some back of the napkin calculations and give it through an NG tube, right? It's not perfect. That's what we do. We figure things out in our community. 10 days later, team gets back, takes a look at him, right? Obviously, he continues to be paralyzed on the right side, but he's eating, he's talking, he's up to a wheelchair. We'll never get neurocritical care rehab, but he's living. Right? These are hard questions. We need to get uncomfortable, or we need to get comfortable being uncomfortable. I think that's what our next future conflict's going to look like. What does that mean? Trepanation, crannies, limb amputations? I can guarantee you the morbidity and mortality associated with me performing a limb amputation is going to be significantly higher than when an orthopedic surgeon does it. But I can also guarantee at some point an avascular necrotic limb that's getting infected, that's going to have a higher morbidity and mortality than me giving it a shot, right? We need to get comfortable with being uncomfortable. Escharotomies, fasciotomies, and for me, my worst feared procedure out there, dental extractions, right? Just hate teeth. Can't do it. But one of the most common things we're going to be called on to do. Right? All right. I'll make this quick. Just run through, especially for the residents in here, right? Think about your ABIM general team, your oral boards. Look at all those resources you have. EM docs, trauma surgeons, anesthesia. You got residents running around, nurses, techs, RT, blood bank, security clerks. Look at all your resources, right? IR suite, CT, surgical subspecialties, blood banking. If I took you forward, I took those away, and I left you with that. This is the construct of the Navy's Role 1 shock trauma squad that goes out with the Marine Expeditionary Units. This is what you got. EM proprietor, a PA, emergency nurse, and independent duty corpsman. You're working with limited class 8, a portable ultrasound, a portable monitor, a portable ventilator, an ISTAT, and maybe a cooler to take some blood products with you if you're lucky. We got to get comfortable being uncomfortable. IVO2 monitor, right? Rolls off everybody's tongue in this room. Let's talk a little bit about IVs. John Otten, anybody in this room know John Otten? There's no doubt. John Otten is one of the world's SMEs when it comes to IO cannulation. John Otten and I also own a fishing boat together in Southern California for offshore fishing. The problem is, offshore fishing in Southern California, 2 to 3 hours to get out to the fishing grounds, 2 to 3 hours of which I have to listen to IO stuff about. Which is great. I like them, but they're fast, but they require training. It's the first skill set when we're task saturated on a small team that we give to the medic or the corpsman, and you got to train for it. And they're temporary. I'll talk a little bit about cortices, right? So I think everybody's probably tracking. First thing I do is I toss out all the triple lumen catheters on deployment stuff. Why do you need a triple lumen? You need volume, right? Get a cortis. And if you're going to get a cortis, why do I say 7 French? Why is that the only size I want? Reboa, right? Compatible. But you know, obviously, you got to make sure that 7 French is going to be compatible if you're going to take Reboa, that you're bringing a 7 French with you. Didn't put it up there, but if you're going to go for an AC line, like, why not the RIC? Right? Why doesn't every AC line get followed up with a RIC? More stable, less chance it's going to blow on you. Oxygen always is a hot issue. I love oxygen too. But if you're talking about hanging on to a patient for 72 hours, it comes down to cube and weight. And to a certain extent, the fact that highly compressed oxygen in a tank where there's a lot of hot lead flying around on a battlefield is typically not a great thing. But just the straight volume of what you need for long-range medicine, it is very challenging. If you have it, fantastic, but from a planning factor, it's really challenging. If you've got young people with relatively good physiology, you know, pre-injury, and we're talking just trauma here, right? Just trauma. I look at fixed equation for oxygen delivery. I can't change the variable on one side. The two that we really have to look at are the hemoglobin, oxygen saturation, right? There's certain things I can do. I can put a chest tube in if there's a lung problem to fit the saturation. But what can I fix the most out of that one compared to giving a little oxygen, taking from 70 to maybe like low 90s? I can fill them back up with hemoglobin. So I don't sweat not having access to oxygen. Of course, I'd like it, but it's not a game changer for me. And then finally, monitoring, right? That's a nursing skill that we put in physician's hands. I think everybody knows, you know, watch a resident go in a room, patient's going crazy, the monitor's going off. We know how to hit the silence button. And then we walk out, we tell the nurse, like, I don't even know what's wrong with the monitor, like without even looking at the vital signs to see if there's a reason the monitor's going off in the first place, right? But it's more than just that, right? It's not just, do you know how to do the buttonology? It's, do we know how to appropriately use the monitors? Do we know how to use end-tidal CO2? We're doing sedations or resuscitations. And then I always probably put a plug in for low-tech solutions. Very similar received patients, you know, kind of that last situation. In a pickup truck coming from hours and hours away, the only intervention that they had done to them, and it was across the board, half dozen patients, the only intervention, not wound washout, not splints, not tourniquets or Foley catheter. Everybody had a Foley catheter. It took me a while to wrap my head around, like, why did we take the time to drop 6 Foley catheters, throw these guys in the truck and get them to somebody else to take care of them? Because if you don't have a monitor and you're in a country where you don't have access to a monitor, that's a pretty good monitor, right? What's the urine output look like over time? So they're useful. Other low-tech solutions, pulse oxes, right? If you're willing to accept a little bit of potential infection control risk, you could carry the pulse ox around from patient to patient to patient. Within 60 seconds, get a pretty good snapshot. Everybody poo-poos the wrist BP cuffs, right? And I'm going to agree, the values you get, well-documented in the literature, are low-fidelity numbers. What I love them for, if you keep the patient in the same position every time you use it, you can follow your trends over time. That's what I care about. I don't care about the number as much as I care about the trend over time. All right, I'm out of time. Okay, I'm going to tell a very brief story here. Iwo Jima has what is not called Iwato has a reunion with honors every year. They're actually, because of COVID, they've finished this up now. But they would bring World War II veterans from Japan and from the United States to the small island, the very, very middle of the Pacific Ocean, for a really, really important ceremony. It was great. And so, of course, they asked for some medical folks to help out. Hey, can you bring your shock trauma platoon out just to make sure nothing happens with these folks who are in their 90s that are coming out to this island out in the middle of nowhere? So, yeah, we'll support you, but like I'm gonna need some medical equipment. We're gonna need an ambulance. Just bring a backpack. It's fine. People in the past have just used a backpack. No. We're gonna bring a big AMOL kit with real supplies, and I'm gonna need an aircraft on standby. Like, you're telling me you need a C-130 stand? Yeah, I need a C-130 standby on the air. Okay. So we fought. We got there a couple days ahead of time. We set up all of our monitors. We plugged them in. We were ready to go. This gentleman who was at Mount Sarabachi on Iwo Jima the first time was being driven there. There was a corporal that was driving the bus. He said, stop the bus at the bottom of the hill. First time I was here, I walked up it. I'm going to walk up it again. Corporal's like, okay, sir. Yes. This mid-90-year-old gentleman walked up to the top of Mount Sarabachi, did just fine, got a ride back down. The ceremony was kind of at the base of the bottom of the island. Halfway through the ceremony, he coats. Right. So we're cardioverting, getting the coals back, grab all of our equipment. We go to the C-130 that we asked to be parked there. Within 10 minutes, the first monitor dies. We had the thing plugged in for 2 days. Right. Nobody did battery maintenance on the monitor. It sat in a warehouse somewhere. That's okay, we got two more. Use a second monitor. What did it do? Crapped out. Third monitor. We are not 45 minutes off of this island trying to get someplace like Guam or Hawaii before we lost all monitoring capabilities on a ROSC patient on multiple drips. We've got intubated on a C-130. So my wrist BP cuff and my pulse ox, they were money. Right. Make fun of them if you want to, but they were money. All right, we're going to fly through a couple of these. So I want to get to this one right here. So, yeah, I get there too. I'm unapologetic about being emotional about these cases. Sergeant Vargas Andrews, 29 surgeries. This kid is doing great, right? He is alive, living at Walter Reed right now with his mom because of some heroes in this room right now that we're taking care of. When his mom calls me, and she does on a daily basis, right? This is a kid who lost vitals multiple times. Spent a whole lot of time on ECMO. He's got a long road to recovery ahead of me. But she says, thank you for his second and his third and his fourth chance at life. There is purpose in what we're doing here. Right? And we have heroes in this room who are responsible for this young man still being alive. And I'm unapologetic about caring about that. So on that note, one of my favorite pictures ever, some of our blood training on one of our Marines. Blue Diamond is a SEAL for the 1st Marine Division. Marines are a big deal to have them on your arms. Apparently this one, they kind of looked the other way when he got this tattoo. But I like it a lot. So any questions or concerns? I know I went a little bit over. If I need to take them afterwards, I'm happy to do so. Okay. Yeah. Sir.
The juniors in the room moving forward. You've hit on it a couple of subtle moments, but I just want to highlight it because I think it's not something in our forefront. It's not something that we train for often. The casualty estimates that you are looking at, you had a slide that showed 60,000 in the last 20 years of war. If we go to war with China, we're talking 40,000 in 2 weeks. And with that comes prolonged field care and expectation management. We've come out of 20 years of war where our expectation is 99% of people who touch a physician aren't going to make it home. That is not what's going to happen if we have 40,000 casualties in 2 weeks. So these medics are coming into it thinking, I need to be a master because everybody will live if they meet me. But that's not what's going to happen. So the mental health aspect of training your teams and debriefing afterwards, I love that text message because right above it, you said, how are you mentally? And that is incredibly important. We don't ask those questions and we don't ask that of our medics. We don't ask that of our residents. We need to.
Fantastic points. All right, I talked too long. I apologize. If there are questions, please grab me during the conference. And I was serious. If there are folks that want to contribute to the joint mission, right, we are looking for people at TCCC. We're looking for people in the PCC groups. We need the help. And we, quite honestly, we need fresh eyes. We need young folks, folks with different experiences to come in and give us a hand. So thank you again.
Next year, And then 1345, come back here for the panel discussion.
GSASEP is proud to be the premier continuing medical education source for military and federal emergency physicians. To purchase CME for the episode you just listened to, please click on the link in the show notes. The Government Services Chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians promotes quality emergency care and enhances the development of emergency physicians who serve our nation from training through retirement. Learn more about our chapter at www.gsacep.org.